Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk in this first block about what is most obviously needed to protect the country we love, especially against enemies foreign, namely a powerful United States military. Anything less won't do. It's not only likely to be inadequate to the task of defending our country, it almost certainly will be insufficient to deter adversaries from believing that they can successfully, or with minimal cost to them, engage in aggression against us or our vital interests. Nobody, I believe, has followed as closely the adequacy of the United States military than our first guest. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Woods, United States military, United States Marine Corps retired. He has been the editor of an incredibly important annual assessment of the adequacy of our military entitled The Index of U.S. Military Strength. It's produced by the Heritage Foundation, where he is a senior research fellow in the defense programs section. He brings to bear expertise as a planner and combat veteran of the United States Marine Corps, as well as a man who has really deeply studied the various means by which one measures military strength. And I'm always proud to have him on our programs. I'm particularly delighted to welcome him on the occasion of the publication of the 9th edition of this incredibly important work. Dakota Wood, welcome back, Colonel. It's good to have you in the house again.
Frank, what a blessing to me to be on your show again. It's been too long, and I'll tell you, just an excellent host, and thanks for diving into such important material.
Well, I intend to have you back soon to do a proper hour on it, but we're going to give people a wave tops examination of some very troubling indicators that you're pointing out of just how short we may be in terms of the military strength. Give us sort of the, 30,000 foot level view of it, if you would, Colonel.
Yeah, I can't help but note we're talking to each other on Halloween. If you want a scary story, this year's index is it. If for the first time in our 9-year run, we've actually scored, the status of U.S. military power is weak, if you can possibly imagine that. So we go from very strong to very weak on our scale, kind of an A through F. This is a solid D grade. And we make these movements between the various categories pretty substantial. So things have to really go bad. But we have a military that is too small. It is much too old in terms of the age of its primary equipment, and it just isn't training as much as it should. And this is not an indictment of soldiers and sailors, airmen, marine, et cetera. And we've got great people joining the military when they come in, but if the average age of an Air Force fighter is 32 years old, Minuteman III ICBMs were bought in the early 1970s and only meant to be there for 10 years. Here we are 50 years later. 55, 60-year-old aerial refuelers. I mean, it just goes across the board. So it's aged equipment, very small, and we'll get into some of those numbers I know you want to, and they just aren't flying, shooting, driving, training enough to maintain core competencies if they were called into action at a large scale.
Yeah. So much to tease out of all of that. I had Lieutenant General David DeTulla, a very highly regarded senior Air Force officer, on the program last week, and he was singing the praises of your new book and pointing out your assessment of the Air Force, and you're noting that it is the smallest, the oldest, and the least ready Air Force since the service was founded shortly after World War II. This is deeply troubling, and we look at certain examples of what that's translating into in practical terms, including the removal of the F-15 right. squadrons from Okinawa right. at the very moment that we're witnessing, this very serious threat from China. going kinetic.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, you know,
talk a little bit about that.
Biden administration just released its national military strategy, and they paint China as, you know, the preeminent, most comprehensive threat, and yet we're removing permanently based units from the Indo-Pacific. You know, the Air Force says they'll have a rotational replacement, but you know, that just in no way replaces somebody who lives in the region, you know, works with the Japanese, is very familiar with that environment. So we're seeing just internal inconsistencies and contradictions by the Biden White House, and it just permeates across the hard combat deployable military power that we would need. Not in the Cold War against a single, you know, unitary opponent, right? The Soviet Union. Now you've got China, Russia, who's going to build back, right, their military power, a near nuclear Iran, and certainly a nuclear power there in North Korea with Crazy Kim. So how do you use a military that's two-thirds and in some cases half the size we had 30 years ago to deal with a much more disordered, threatening world? You know, you just can't square those corners. And we're seeing the real consequences of that.
We're going to be talking, just to round this picture out, and a little bit later in the program with Bill Walton, about the loss of Brazil this weekend, meaning that essentially the entire hemisphere, basically from the Arctic to the Antarctic, is now in the hands of leftist governments with ties to the Chinese Communist Party. As part of a larger Belt and Road program that is potentially making the whole rest of the world, you know, a power projection opportunity for China. One of the things that I so appreciate about the work you do with this index, and I know it's not entirely your work, but it's the team that you lead at the Heritage Foundation, and it's your ability to understand that military power, military strength, as you call it, isn't a function of just one, you know, sort of capability. Yeah. It's not the number of aircraft alone. It's the number of aircraft. It's where they are. It's how ready they are. It's whether the pilots are trained. It's whether they've got the war reserves to keep them, you know, operational in times of combat, all that. And you get into that with a great granularity that I think is really important to our audience and others as they're trying to figure out, you know, how great is the danger we're facing. I did just want to say one of the other very important ingredients, as you know so well, Colonel, is the quality of the personnel manning the force. And you're down there, as I understand it, in North Carolina, bringing your son into the infantry of the United States Marine Corps. And I want to thank you for your service, of course, but also for his. Talk a little bit about the challenges that we're facing with personnel in today's military and how that's contributing to this weakness.
Yeah, at the grassroots level, I mean, you know, our junior enlisted and officers are just fantastic people. You know, if you're trying to keep a 30-year-old airplane running, you know, what are those work hours on the flight line, right? In the Cold War, we had nearly 600 ships. Today, we have 292. That will drop to 280. So if you have half the vessels, but you keep the same number deployed, 100 on any given day with half the fleet, what are the work hours, you know, that a young seaman working in the engine room is doing to keep those things working? So our scoring of the military is weak. It's not an indictment of the people. We have fantastic individuals. Now, unfortunately, all the social engineering that's being imposed on the U.S. military, this wokeism, critical race theory, diversity and equity commissars, you know, the apparatchiks of the White House, these sorts of things are very frustrating for those in the military. It takes time away from things you could be doing to fix a tank or an airplane. You know, they hustle you into a classroom and want you to view each other through a racial lens. When they know in their own daily living, it doesn't matter if you're Hispanic, Black, white, you know, Mormon, Protestant, Christian, it doesn't matter. You've been through the same training. You're doing the same work for our country.
And if you think otherwise, you're not going to have unit cohesion, which we need. Absolutely. Dakota Wood is in the house. We'll be right back with more of him right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Elderly federal judge Kenneth Hoyt put two election integrity activists in jail yesterday until they publicly identify and thereby put at risk a reported FBI confidential informant. The practical effect of Judge Hoyt capriciously locking up True the Votes, Catherine Engelbrecht, and Greg Phillips is to prevent them from warning of an ominous prospect. Communist China may be able to exploit access given to sensitive electoral data by the indicted CEO of Connect Inc. to affect our midterms a week from today. Suppressing such information could make a difference in turnout and outcomes, just as preventing voters from knowing the truth about Hunter Biden's laptop did in the 2020 presidential race. That would make Judge Hoyt's arbitrary decision tantamount to election interference. My old boss Ronald Reagan, who appointed him to the bench 35 years ago, must be spinning in his grave. This is Frank Affney. We're back. We're visiting with Lieutenant Colonel Dakota Wood, United States Marine Corps retired, now a senior research fellow with the wonderful Heritage Foundation. We're talking about a brand new book, the ninth edition, in fact, of a series of these very important assessments of the military strength of the United States. And Dakota, I just can't overstate, I think, the importance of this effort that you mount year after year after year. And sadly, over the course of those 9 years, I think we've seen more or less uninterrupted decline in the quality of the force. Again, not necessarily the individual personnel, particularly at the lower ranks, but of the force as a whole, and you've done a great job of characterizing it. I did want to ask you, just to wrap up your thought about personnel, because I think what you've described in terms of this woke agenda, the critical race theory and the indoctrination, and then on top of it, the purges, and now the vaccine mandate related purges, have had to have been debilitating. Not just obviously to the attraction of new people to the force, but the retention of the ones that we have who we desperately need right. to be there. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, you know, Marines and soldiers and airmen, we find that those units that are more operationally deployed, that have greater unit cohesion, people want to reenlist. You know, they want to stay in, right? So there's this draw to stay in. When you are focused on your job, war fighting skills, et cetera, right? But when you find these long periods where you're in a garrison environment, you find that at the local base library, they're having a drag show queen, you know, talking about genderqueer theory to 6 and 7 year olds, right? Or you've got your gay.
Your kids.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, why would you want to be in that sort of military? So the social engineering stuff is really bad. We also find we're having a problem with American culture writ large. 3 out of 4 American youth between 17 and 24 are dealing with obesity, health problems, criminal records, substance abuse, or psychiatric problems, and they are ineligible to join the military. So your recruiting pool is barely a quarter of American youth. Of that 17 to 24-year-old pool, fewer than 1 in 10 have any interest whatsoever in joining the military. And it's because our society, and especially social media and the left-wing mainstream media, paint the military as full of racists, sexual harassers. If you join, you're going to get post-traumatic stress disorder. It's just broken. All those are just lies. It's just fiction. But that's what the left would have you believe of a military that supposedly is guarding a country that is inherently racist from its origins. You know, Project 1619 and all that nonsense. So we've got all of these forces that are bearing upon our culture, our society, that make people reluctant to join. So how much more noble is the service of those that do, and they find out that that was all just poppycock, you know, that it's worthwhile service, band of brothers. You have greater opportunity, more protections serving in our military than you do in any other walk of life. But it does affect the recruiting environment. You know, the Air Force is so short of pilots that if you have a pulse, you're going to graduate from flight school. They have a 94% graduation rate. Of those that just find that they are unable to learn how to fly, less than one half of 1% are dropped from pilot training in the Air Force due to the inability to learn, right? The rest of them are kind of legal problems or whatever it might be. So that tells you either everybody is perfect when they come in, or we've had to so lower our standards in some of the training just to keep people in, right? So it's an indicator, and that's what we try to convey.
Yeah, that, and that's really the concern in so much of this is that having imposed these kinds of forces on the military, and I can't, again, exaggerate how demoralizing it must be to be told endlessly that the country that you're putting your life on the line to protect is unworthy of your sacrifice. But when you add on top of that, those demographic phenomena, and then this sort of, well, I think of it as cultural Marxist takedown of our society writ large, it's a deeply, deeply troubling picture. Let me come back to the ship situation, because obviously if the balloon goes up with the Chinese Communist Party, and I fear that that's a distinct possibility in the not too distant future, a kinetic engagement, not just the unrestricted warfare, we're going to need not only old hands on deck, we're going to need a lot more ships than we've got. And the Navy is talking, as you say, about retiring combatant vessels that still have useful life on them. What is going on here? Is this just another case of trying to have to sacrifice something now in order to get new ships built for the future? Or are they making these force structure decisions in a way that is certain to invite aggression, I think, on the part of our enemies?
Yeah, weakness does provoke, you know, opportunism, exploitation, and a much more aggressive posture. So this is going to sound kind of nerdy, right? But it does come down to dollars and how we understand money. $800 billion for defense is a lot of money in anybody's book. But over 30 years, we have become attuned or normalized to relatively low levels of funding given the nature of combat. We operate 6,000-8,000 miles from home. China operates within 200 or 300 miles of its coastline. So those are two radically different military forces. They're concerned about the Indo-Pacific. We have global obligations and interests, you know, due to access to markets, you know, just our capitalist interests and all. So it just takes more, right? So if you've increased the defense budget this year by 4%, but inflation is going at 8 or 9%, right? You just can't buy fuel and ammunition and repair parts as you would need. If you're spending 3% of GDP on your military, the Cold War, it was 5 or 6%. You're just not keeping up with the costs of what it takes to produce a frontline fighter or ship. So the Navy is having to sacrifice good capabilities, numbers matter in battle, so that they can reapply those funds to get other new ships that they desperately need as the old stuff ages out. And so Congress is not allocating sufficient funding to do both, to maintain numbers and bring in new gear. So of those 290 ships we have today, 100 are deployed on any given day. About 60 of those are in the Indo-Pacific. China has built from 220 to 360 ships in about the last 10 or 15 years. So they have a 6-to-1 advantage within a few hundred miles of their coast, where they can use land-based anti-ship cruise missiles, land-based maritime patrol aircraft, their Coast Guard, their maritime
ballistic missiles,
thousands of ships, right, against our relatively small Navy. And you would want to be able to rely on Vietnam or Indonesia or the Philippines or Japan. They have virtually nothing as well. So these are the truths we try to convey in a report. The military section alone has over 700 footnotes. So everything we say is accessed via a public source that any reader can go to, right? It's the work of 20 authors across 2,500 citations and nearly 600 pages of material. So the government isn't telling you this. The Pentagon often doesn't know, right, that we had to correct the Air Force's numbers on how many squadrons they have a couple of years ago. The army has dropped from 770,000 soldiers at the end of the Cold War to barely 470,000 this year, over 300,000 soldiers lost in the last three decades. And they believe that because of the recruiting environment, by the end of next year, they'll be below 450,000. So the smallest, oldest, unready Air Force since before World War II, an army that's almost half of what it needs to be for global operations, a Navy, you know, again, that's half the size of what it had during the Cold War. It's just small. It's not funded at appropriate levels for flying. Air Force pilots used to fly well in excess of 200 hours a year. Today, the average Air Force pilot is less than 120 hours.
We could go on and on, and we're going to when we get you back, Dakota. Thanks, Wood. Frank. But for the moment, thank you for this excellent introduction to your new Index of U.S. Military Strength. It's required reading. You can get it at the Heritage Foundation website, I believe.
Heritage.org/military.
Heritage.org. Go there, my friends. Thank you, Dakota. Talk with you again soon. We'll be right back with more about Iran right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we're going to be turning our attention now to Iran, a nation that has been in the, a revolution for several weeks now, and it shows no sign of abating, thankfully. And the question is, where is it going, and what will come next, and what should we be doing to help? Our guest to discuss all of this is Marty Yosefiani. He is an accomplished strategic communicator these days with the Cassidy Ballesta Group, and a man who hails from Iran and has just returned from the region for, an on-site inspection of what's going on there at the moment. So we're very pleased to catch up with him. Marty, thank you for joining us. You were a very, very important contributor to a webinar that our Center for Security Policy recently had on this very subject, and we wanted to double back with you and take stock of where things stand now and where they're going as you see it. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Frank, for having me back. As you said, I just came back, so it's sort of the gap between keeping read of what's happening. But I always tell my colleagues and associates that it's important to look at trend lines and not worry about the daily and hourly and minute by minute action, because frankly, there is a lot going on. Demonstrations in over 80 cities, all across Iran, small, large, medium sized cities, provinces, and elsewhere. The most important development, I believe, that we can look at, which is an indicator again, is what happened on Sunday. And that is when it was a day that the country had been warned by the IRGC commander-in-chief, Salami, that no more protests will be tolerated. Well, when a commander, when a leader or military chief makes such declaration, leaders want to make sure it's not just bluster and that that word is taken into account. Well, the day after, 81 universities, again, energetic and unfortunately violent demonstrations were taken out across Iran. And so one wonders, how does that reflect internally within the regime? And on the other side, the confidence level that it projects onto the people and the streets when they start realizing that perhaps that baton and that suppression machine may not be as well oiled as they thought.
This is heartening. I'm also hearing some reports that the army is now beginning to provide safe haven for some of those fleeing the Islamic Revolutionary Guard and their proxies, the Basiji. Are you getting anything like that in the way of reports? Would that sound credible to you? And if so, it would seem as though that would be a rather big deal.
Yeah, I too have heard those reports, but as we suggested earlier, I just came back. I have not been able to personally, but I have heard from multiple sources that that has happened, whereby the professional army, as you know, we have the IRGC, the Sepah, on one hand, core of the revolution, and then we have the professional army, which has institutional knowledge of what it was before the revolution, a prominent professional army. And the reports are that various camps, storage facilities and training camps of the professional army have been opened to offer refuge to demonstrators. We hope that it's a matter of time that will happen. Not necessarily only the professional army, but we hope that eventually members of this suppression machine will realize that they no longer can shoot on their brothers and sisters and people they know in the neighborhood, and that will happen soon.
Yeah, well, from your lips to God's ears, as they say, Marty. When you look at the various aspects of the society, the economy most especially, that have begun to come into alignment with the demonstrators. Initially, I think women protesting the murder of a woman for not having adequately covered her hair. It seems as though key sectors, including the oil and gas sector, the transportation sector, the medical professional community, and the like, are now on strike or are participating in other ways in these demonstrations. Again, the trend, I guess, is what is of particular importance here. Are those data points on the trend, and do you think they augur importantly for the future of this revolution?
Absolutely. Just as the demonstrations have included all sectors of society, we also see indications of declarations of strikes by the most important sectors of the economy, whether it be oil and gas, as you said, or the transportation, the truckers, to certainly the universities, certain medical staff, the bazaar in multiple cities, and so on and so forth. The issue, however, is to be able to sustain them. Unlike 1978, where we had the Islamic sort of network of the masjid who were able to literally feed the protesters in the streets at night, we need to make sure these blue-collar workers, when they go on strike, they can sustain their families for weeks and months on end.
This brings us to, again, not just the prospects for this revolution staying the course and ultimately achieving the desired end, but also what can we do in the United States to provide support? both, you know, what and how, to the extent you can shed any light on that, Marty.
Yeah, that's critically important, Frank, especially for the diaspora in the United States, the Iranian American community, which, as you know, is 3 million strong, very well educated, and one of the most affluent community immigrant groups in the United States. It is important for us to have a good understanding with the leaders of our communities and our government. And when we see the Biden administration, for example, say the right things in terms of, well, yes, we are paying attention to the demands and wishes of the Iranian street, well, it's important to translate that into policy. We see and have only seen for the past 40 years sanctions as a tool. And it's very critical to understand what sanctions are. Philosophically, sanctions are meant to cause change in behavior. Well, if today in Iran, we see the Iranian people say that this regime is not legitimate, cannot reform, cannot change its behavior, and thus we have come to the conclusion that it must go, well, Western powers who say they are listening to the Iranian people, in my view, must accommodate that perspective. So sanctions, while symbolically a gesture, they are basically actions without taking real actions. Case in point, when the administration announces sanctions on 3 or 4 individuals who killed Mahsa Amini, well, it's nice to hear they've been sanctioned, but chances are those individuals do not have bank accounts or properties or assets in the West or in the United States. So it's symbolic. Now, you asked in terms of what can actually be done. I think it's very, very important at this point, if we are following the Iranian street, that policymakers join in the delegitimization of the Iranian regime. How can we do that, one asks? Well, there are any number of international organizations that Iran belongs to. Come to name FIFA, World Cup right around the corner. The Iranian people are demanding the expulsion of the regime's team. In fact, members of the athletic community have also said the same, not to give credibility to the regime. We have a number of women's organizations, for example, one in particular, the United Nations, where the Islamic regime ironically chairs the committee. Well, that particular committee, I would submit, should expel that individual and symbolically replace it with, for example, a Nazanin Bonyadi, who in fact serves in some capacity officially with the United Nations. So these are actions that can actually be done to A, delegitimize the regime, and B, tell the people that we are there with you, seriously taking action.
We have only a minute left, Marty, but let me ask you about specifically what Robert Malley, the lead negotiator and interlocutor with the Iranian regime, albeit through cutouts, including the Russians, amazingly enough, at the moment. Should he be, first of all, directed to stop the negotiations on a so-called nuclear agreement, and better yet, be told to resign?
Well, that's exactly the calls that we heard from the Iranian American community these past weekends happening. There is a view within our community that the administration is not necessarily in tune with what's going on, A, in Iran, and B, with the Iranian American community. And that is largely because those who are whispering in their ears in the past have been what's called the Iran lobby. Mr. Malley, while...
We have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Marty, we are hard out of time. Come back to us soon with further updates, if you would. We'll be right back with more Securing America right after this. We'll be right back. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being each week about this time, by Bill Walton, the host of The Bill Walton Show, a former Master of the Universe on Wall Street at Allied Capital, also a president of the Council for National Policy, of which I'm very pleased to be a member, a very important conservative movement organization. He brings a wealth, in other words, of skills and background to all of the topics we discuss, and we're anxious to get some thoughts from him on several that are top of my mind. Bill, I want to start with Brazil. In the past day or so, we've seen the last of the major nations of our hemisphere fall to the, well, communists. Lula da Silva is, I think, without a doubt, one, and he brings with him the help of the Chinese Communist Party, as do all of those nations that have now, I think, succumbed to the leftist temptation. Give us your take on what the implications are of this, not just obviously for the people of Brazil most immediately and the region, but for us as well.
Well, it's another ominous development if you care about freedom and markets and human flourishing. Brazil has become the last country in Central America to go left, returning to Lula's so-called leadership. And of course, Lula campaigned on giving the government a central role in the economy and supposed privatization of industries. And of course, he's going to eliminate income taxes on anyone earning less than $950 a month, which is virtually the entire country. And he's going to tax the rich. Well, the journal reports this is the last Central American or Latin country to go left, but the journal doesn't reflect the fact that it's really the entire Americas. If you look at the government with Trudeau in Canada and now Biden and his crew in the United States, the entire Americas have gone left. And what's particularly ominous in South and Central America is the communist role in helping bringing this about. And so we're up against it, Frank. It was a close election, supposedly. It was 50.5% to 49.5% where he beat Bolsonaro. And I don't think Bolsonaro is not yet conceded. But my guess is that this is a fait accompli. And it's not good for freedom.
It's definitely not good for freedom. I guess we'll see what Bolsonaro does do as a result of some concerns about election fraud, which he expressed before the election, as a matter of fact. But Bill, one of the bigger problems, as I touched on a moment ago, is that it's not just these indigenous communists. It's not just their organization around something called the Forum of São Paulo that Lula was instrumental in setting up when he was president of Brazil years ago, prior to his conviction on criminal felony charges. But we have a Brazil, Peru, Chile, Colombia, and the nations of Central America by and large, right on up, as you say, to our own country and to Canada. In other words, from the Arctic to the Antarctic, now under the sway of governments that are, well, in the pocket of the Chinese Communist Party. I don't know that that's an exaggeration. They're certainly subject to its influence in an extreme way, but it seems as though mostly they're doing its bidding. And that is not just bad for freedom, that is bad fundamentally for our national security as well, is it not?
Well, I think freedom's part of that, Frank. But, you know, the Chinese are definitely there. They've been working Sure. assiduously at this for a couple of decades now. But there are other forces at work. There's the usual Marxist ideology. But I think the climate change group are also involved in this, because Bolsonaro very properly decided that to save the rainforest in Brazil, private development of it would be far better than what was happening with it in government hands, where it was being cut down by basically forest pirates and ruining it. So what was a very constructive environmental policy under him is now going to be reversed, and we're going to go back to the bad old days. You know, Brazil is in a very interesting case here, because when he was president 20 years ago or 15 years ago, Brazil had its wind at the back. China was rising rapidly. They were exporting lots of food to China. And also they just discovered their energy reserves or more of them, and they benefited from that. None of that is true today. And, you know, in addition to the big forces at work, we've got sort of the global degrowth crew that think that, you know, if the economy doesn't grow, we just redistribute things, the world's going to be better. Well, that's never worked. And the only thing that's brought people, billions of peoples, out of poverty is a free market economy. And there are lots of forces to pushing back on that. And this Amen. Is just the latest chapter.
Well, and on top of all of that, I think you've got, as you say, the globalists who are very much bent on the idea that the population of the world is too large, and therefore we need to engineer it so that there are fewer of us. Redistributing the wealth among them, but it'll be fewer and fewer.
Yeah. Well, they've got the demographics wrong. That may have been a worry 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, maybe, even though it wasn't. But if you look at the population trends in all the major developed countries, they're heading downward, and including, I might add, China. Yeah.
They're plummeting.
So, yeah. They're fighting the last century's battle, and we got a lot of work to do, Frank.
Well, it's I think eugenics is bent on a much, much smaller population worldwide. Bill, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I do want to ask you about one piece of this that's very troubling out of Mexico, concerning the idea of a new transnational arrangement like the European Union for our hemisphere. We'll get to that and much more with Bill Walton on the other side of a very short break, the host of The Bill Walton Show, a program that I strongly commend to all of you, as well as, of course, our visits with him here. We'll be right back with more right after this. Bill Walton is in the house. Welcome back. We're going to be continuing our conversation a little bit more about Brazil and then turn to other topics. Bill, there's a report, I believe, out of Mexico that I caught, and I wondered if you had seen it, and if not, have any thoughts about it, that Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State of the United States, has been involved in conversations with Manuel López Obrador, the radical leftist who runs Mexico these days. Well, runs it alongside the drug cartels, of course. But they have apparently been discussing the idea of having some new European Union style arrangement between the various nations of this hemisphere that would, as with Europe, give rise to some new sort of supranational organization under which the various sovereign states would be subordinated, and not so sovereign at that. Have you seen anything along these lines? Would it surprise you if that's what these guys have in mind, and how bad an idea would it be?
Well, this is like that line from Casablanca where they're in the casino and somebody expresses dismay that there's gambling going on. You know, Blinken is nothing if he's not an open border globalist bent on having elites dominate societies. And putting together a European style bloc with Canada, United States, and Mexico would be a dream. Of course, that would dramatically shrink U.S. sovereignty. And we've seen in Europe, the EU hasn't exactly worked out all that well for the people in Europe. Even economically, they're shrinking.
Yeah, and that's for sure.
To try to bring that here is just another really bad idea and something we need to fight.
Amen. Speaking of things we need to fight, Bill, another dream of the hard left, of course, is the idea of moving us away from nasty fossil fuels in favor of, sustainable, as they call it, wind and solar power and the like. Bill, we're about to run out of diesel fuel as a result, it seems, of this deliberate desire and policy of forcibly weaning us from such fuels. Talk about what the implications of a diesel, well, not just shortage, but outage would involve.
Well, the backstory here is that, you know, this diesel shortage has been brought to us by largely, I mean, there are other sort of normal seasonal factors at work, but a big part of it is that we've cut off exports or imports from Russia of distillates that go into diesel fuels. I mean, it's more technical than that, but essentially we've cut back supply dramatically. And the implications of running out of diesel means that our big trucks, the 18-wheelers, aren't going to have the fuel to run on, and that's going to also be another shock to our supply chain, food supply, and the economy in the United States. And Frank, you know, the political class is just absolutely clueless.
And trains too, as I understand it, Bill. It's not just the trucks; it's the rail system too.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it's just, you know, we've seen this before. 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago, we shut down the economies because of the COVID, quote, crisis and locked down the economy, and that we still have not recovered from. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of businesses have gone under because of that. And now we've got the same thing where you've got the political class saying, well, we need to have sanctions on Russia. And who pays the price? Ordinary people. We're going to pay a big price this winter, not only with shortage of diesel fuels, but heating oil. I mean, if you're up in New Hampshire or Maine where it gets very cold, a lot of this shortage is occurring on the East Coast, and they're going to pay a big price for this, our latest adventure in Europe.
No question about it. Well, adventures is one way to describe it. It's yeah. Domestic policies as well as foreign that are compounding this, no doubt about it. Bill, one of the things I know you've been concerned about as a conservative movement leader is election integrity.
Yeah.
You've also had as a guest on your show, as I understand it, several times, Robert Epstein, who was featured prominently in a terrific, I have to say, hour-long program on Tucker Carlson's Today Show, which is a feature of Fox Nation. And Robert Epstein was talking about Google's ability to manipulate public opinion, particularly in the context of elections. And he had some absolutely stunning statistics on the basis of modeling and simulations that he's done that have helped give real insight into what Google is up to. I know you haven't had a chance to look at this show, but the main takeaway from it is that, for me at least, there is a bias built into what Google is doing, and that they did in the 2020 election. He was able to bring it to the attention of Senator Ted Cruz, and Senator Cruz and two of his colleagues apparently engaged very directly with the leadership of Google and persuaded them to turn off the bias algorithm or mechanisms so as not to influence the election, the runoff election in Georgia in 2021. It seems as though if this mechanism is operating in this midterm election, it needs to be turned off now. Wouldn't you agree?
I would so agree. And I haven't seen it. I've had Robert on for, I guess, two or three shows a year or two ago. And what he was saying then is just as true now. And I'm sure he shared this with Tucker. The thing about Robert is that he is not a wild-eyed conspiracy guy. He's a very careful scientist. And in fact, he's a very hardcore liberal, voter.
Let alone a conservative.
What's that?
Yeah.
He's not a conservative.
Let alone a conservative.
But he's, well, quote, right, as the favorite phrase is now, he's followed the science and he's looked at the Google search engine. And putting it quite simply, if you type in a search phrase into Google, these results turn up. And of course, you can easily manipulate what people think about what's going on by the search results that show up. And just for fun, go home and try this at home. Type in something like Fetterman, and Google will probably show you all the favorable articles about what a great candidate that we have in Pennsylvania.
Perfect example. Bill, we have to leave it at that. I'm afraid we are hard out of time. Thank you for yours, and thank you for joining us all. I hope you'll do so again next time. This is Frank Gaffney, over and out.